This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. I first heard the music duo known as the Handsome Family on season one of HBO's True Detective when their mysterious, haunting song, Far From Any Road, was used as the theme music. I liked it so much I went back and listened to their other recordings. They have a new album called Unseen, so of course we invited them on the show. Brett Sparks writes the music. Rennie Sparks writes the lyrics. Brett sings lead and plays most of the instruments. Rennie sings backup and plays banjo and auto harp. This description is from the magazine Absolute Sound. Quote, Rennie's creepy modern tales of sudden death, paranormal mysteries, descents into madness, and God-fearing maladies unsmirkingly meld with Brett's achingly beautiful melodies and tender ballads. Unquote. Brett and Rennie have been married since 1993 and have lived in Albuquerque since 2001. The Southwest desert helps set the mood for some of their recordings, but as we'll discuss, some of the dark atmosphere in their music comes from dealing with their own dark moods. Let's start with the opening track of Unseen. This is Gold.
Got a tattoo of a snake and a ski mask on my face, but I woke up in a ditch behind the stop and go, lying in the weeds with a bullet in my gut, watching
That's Gold from the new Handsome Family album, Unseen. Brett and Rennie Sparks, welcome to Fresh Air. I love your music, and it's a pleasure to have you on the show. So let's talk about the story behind that song. So just like the story itself. So this character wakes up in a ditch behind the stop and go with a bullet in his gut. This is definitely like the start of a story. Do you know what happened?
Yeah.
Do you know who he is?
It's based on an actual occurrence that happened when we first moved to town. I went out to buy, you know, the six pack or whatever, and went down to the local convenience store, and I got out of the car and there was a swirling twister of dust, and in this twister were dozens and dozens of bills, like singles, fives, twenties, just in the air. And it was just a really very surreal experience. So I got home and told this to Rennie. You wouldn't believe what happened to me. I got $56 in loose bills that were flying through the air.
Well, that's the difference between the two of us was, I think, clear there, because you came home so happy, and I immediately thought there's got to be someone dying in a ditch, because that's the only way anyone lets go of a fistful of dollars in this town.
Yeah, and that, to me, I really liked that first line. I got a tattoo of a snake and a ski mask on my face. When I read that, Rennie gives me the lyrics. The way we work is always lyrics first and then music. And when she gave me that lyric, I think that lyric was in the fourth verse, and I read that line and I was like, that is the perfect way to start a record. Just like, you know, a 1-2 punch.
The other funny true thing about this, well, not so funny, is that at our local Wells Fargo, there is a sign in the lobby, and this is New Mexico, where you don't wear a ski mask, really, except to rob a bank.
So you don't wear a ski mask for any reason.
There is a sign that says, please no ski mask
or
mirrored sunglasses to be worn in the lobby. Just to, you know, that way they can clearly see who's there to rob the bank, give them like a 5-second lead.
It's the Wild Wild West, so it's kind of a song that has the trappings of that Wild Wild West stuff.
Yeah, well, Rennie, in your lyrics, I mean, there's a lot of sun. There's a fair amount of, like, snakes and creatures that seem to be very much of the desert, and, you know, poisonous plants and the kind of thing that you wouldn't find on the streets of Philly, for instance.
Yeah, it is amazing out here that the insects are, when I first moved here, I would almost have like a feeling like I was having a psychotic break when I'd see these insects that were just, my brain couldn't fathom that they were real. Mm-hmm. But they're incredibly beautiful and frightening.
So I want to play the song that you're probably best known for, Far From Any Road, which was used as the theme song, the opening theme music, for season one of HBO's True Detective. And I watched the series, and one of the things I really looked forward to every week was hearing the theme.
And
yeah, so
us too.
Yeah, I can imagine. Let's hear it, and yeah. then we'll talk about it. So this is Far From Any Road, the Handsome Family, and you'll recognize it as the theme from season one of True Detective. The Handsome Family, and my guests are Brett and Rennie Sparks. Let's talk about what you intended when you wrote the song, because you wrote the song years before it was actually used as the True Detective theme. And it's the kind of song where you can debate, like, what does it mean? is this character dying from a rattlesnake bite, from a poisoned flower, or is this character just haunted by the hallucinations brought on by a cactus psychedelic plant? So you tell me.
Yes, all of those.
Right.
Well, that's what's great. I mean, those are my favorite songs are the ones that have holes in them, and you have to, you know, leave the listener something to try to puzzle out for himself, you know?
There should be some space for many different theories.
To me, that was the first real desert song that we wrote, too, and we wrote it almost as pastiche to me. Like, I really want to nail, like, that sound, you know, so I took the sound of the castanets as insects from Sketches of Spain, and using classical guitar, you know, and sounds like that, and kind of the Morricone thing, and it's an obvious homage to Lee Hazlewood and Nancy Sinatra. That's undeniable in the exchange between the woman and the man. And then it got used for a cop show set in Louisiana, so.
But that's what's so wonderful about it, I think, is that a song should have space that it can take on many meanings and take on many lives and can be put in different contexts and fit perfectly. So to me, that was just like the most gratifying thing you could have for a song to be bigger than you could imagine it to be. I do think, though, once again, it's about insects, because that was completely inspired for me by this horror that I had as an Easterner. I grew up in New York, and when we first moved out there, when I discovered the hard way that ants can bite you viciously.
She was working out in the driveway on something, I don't know, repaving the driveway or something. And she got bit by all these big fire ants, you know, like almost the size of your pinky. And yeah.
It went on and on and on for days, that
you
pain.
You hallucinated the lyrics to that song.
I do remember distinctly, though, that summer we were recording that song, that was a summer of cicadas. You know, that's like every 7 or 9 or, you know, odd number, prime number years that the cicadas come. And they
seven,
were deafeningly loud outside, and you were getting them on the track. And I think it kind of worked with it.
I think they are on the track. And instead of, you know, looking at Brian Eno's oblique strategies, instead of like trying to save the track and get rid of the noise and the cicadas, I decided to put more on there, but more through the use of actual instruments like claves and, you know, castanets and güiros and stuff, so that when you mixed all this big mess together, it just sounded like this big giant chorus of insects, which is what the mandolins are doing in the chorus too. They're like these fluttering wings, you know, like having that mandolin molted 7 or 8 times, like a mandolin choir. That to me sounded very insectoid too. So.
And you have a home studio, home recording studio.
Yeah, that's why I can do these stupid things. That's why I can do these, get these ridiculous ideas in my head and then actually, you know, pursue them.
So
it's really hard for me to work in a regular studio anymore. It's very difficult.
So your songs are largely not autobiographical, but there is at least one song that's kind of an exception. And it's called My Ghost.
And but, I was just going to remind you, though, that I write the lyrics. So, you know, there's only so much autobiography in a song that I've written about someone else's experience.
But you're writing it for
Brett to sing. Weird,
so, yeah.
There's a lot of weird ambiguity going on when we, when she writes. Because that song, well, go ahead and finish the intro.
Yes, well, let me just finish the thought. Yeah, so to finish out that thought, Ghost is about having been hospitalized after a bipolar episode, probably an episode of mania. And
That's how you get locked up.
Yeah, the calm moments they really don't care about.
and this character is basically not getting out of the ward until he's able and willing to comb his hair and brush his teeth and things like that. So I know that there was a period probably in the 90s, Brett, when you did have a break. And
5/9/95.
Yeah, palindrome.
The palindrome date drove you over the edge, I remember.
Yeah, yep, that's right.
Why don't we hear the song, and then we'll talk. So the song is called My Ghost. The music is by Brett, and the lyric is by Rennie. This is The Handsome Family.
Ghost drives around with a bag of dead fish, falling neutrinos drift through the trees. He staggers and reels, runs up credit card bills, and clogs up the toilet with bottles of pills. Here in the bipolar ward, if you shower, you get a gold star. But I'm not going far till the Haldol kicks in. Until
can you tell us a story of writing that song?
So that song was started by me about trying to write about my experience.
In the hospital.
Yeah, mental illness in the hospital. But I don't write lyrics. That's not my thing. But I thought the idea was good. So Rennie took up the lyric and turned it into a lyric. Or took up the idea and turned it into a lyric. And so that's weird. I mean, that's another level of strangeness, you know, bouncing back and forth between the two of us. That song's tough to do. And we get a lot of requests for it. And I'm usually just like, no, I just don't want to go there.
It's tough to do because, not for technical reasons, but for emotional ones.
Well, it's not even that. It's more like kind of, dealing with this illness I've come to realize the fact that there's nothing cool about it.
Most people in mental hospitals are not artists. They're just very sick
people. Yeah, they're just really, really sad, screwed up people. And it's not, it's something I don't really want to reinforce with people.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think they take it as kind of funny, and it is funny. And that's where I was at when I wrote the song, was trying to make some fun out of it. But it's really not funny anymore. It just is, you know. And it's not the greatest song in the world. It's a simple 1/6, you know, it's a doo-wop song, basically. It has the same chord progression as, like, Heart and Soul or something, whatever.
Let me ask you about a specific line in the song. My ghost drives around with a bag of dead fish.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was a bad day.
Yeah, it was a bad day. Yeah, I had this fish tank. I was really into fish when I was a kid. Like, I was really into aquariums. And people who are bipolar shouldn't be allowed to keep fish tanks.
It didn't end well.
It did not end well.
No, you were driving around with those fish in the car, and you were making some kind of recording antenna to reach...
Yeah.
Outer space people in the car, and he was eating cat food.
Yeah, it was
a mess.
Had all the cliches.
It was pretty ugly stuff.
Champagne and cat food.
But yeah,
see,
afterwards,
I'm making fun of it now.
You know, it is funny to go. You know, while you were in the hospital, I was going around returning your purchases. He spent like thousands of dollars on pillows, and I went
pillows.
To Bed Bath and Beyond. And I said my husband had a manic episode. Can I return these pillows? And people were nice about it. When you say someone did this when they were crazy, they'll usually take the pillows back.
Well, this is why I don't go there.
Well, I'll ask about one other line. You referred to this. He staggers and reels and runs up credit card bills and clogs up the toilet with bottles of pillows. Were you not taking your medication?
I think
that's
you were just, you were prescribed the wrong medication is what was happening. Mm-hmm. You were being prescribed things
that,
for depression.
You know, that may have just been a good rhyme.
That could
and
be,
that is a
yeah.
damn good rhyme.
No, I remember you were taking the wrong, I think that may have brought you into a manic
Runs
state.
Runs up credit card bills is a classic bipolar trait of over-shopping.
A lot of people are put into manic states by being prescribed antidepressants. Because they first go to a doctor because they're experiencing depression, and no one's seen the manic side of it.
Yeah, because nobody goes where they're manic.
So it is a bit dangerous when you first take antidepressants. You can end up in a very dangerous manic place.
Randy, do you have a mood disorder too? Because I read something along those lines. Mm-hmm. what's your thing?
I'm just a very depressed person, I guess, when I'm, you know, I'm hopped up on a lot of antidepressants, and this is as happy as I get. But I think both of us recognize that without modern pharmaceuticals, neither of us have survived this long. So we're fortunate that there is medication out there that can help us have a life.
Has it helped you understand each other, knowing that you both have to deal with a mood disorder?
Well, I think the funny thing was, I think we had a discussion about this once when we first met, that I was secretly thinking, well, he'll be my rock because I know I'm going to be crazy. Turns out, you know,
I think
drowning together, we've managed to tread water.
I think it's made us a lot more patient with one another and tolerant with one another. And I think, quote unquote, normal people sometimes lose patience with each other. And that's why their relationships disintegrate. But I think we know that sometimes the other person needs a little extra slack.
I know you both like a lot of traditional music. And so much of the traditional music, you know, the American like folk traditions and British folk traditions, they're ballads about lost love, about murder, about, you know, country music too, about like sinning and having lost your way, and you do a couple of traditional things. So I want to play a traditional song called "The Lost Soul" that you say you first heard on the Doc Watson Family album, and this is a really dark song. Mm-hmm. Do you want to quote some of the lyrics before we hear it?
What an awful day.
What an awful day.
When the judgment comes.
When the judgment comes.
And the sinners hear their eternal doom.
That's a good time religion.
Oh, help, I cry, but it all in vain. For alas, I'm doomed. For a, I'm doomed. For a. Yep, happy stuff.
Why did you decide to sing this?
Oh, it seems obvious.
I think it's, for me, it's comforting. I don't know why. I guess just because I think I also, I really like horror movies and I like books about disasters because they kind of match the mood that I'm naturally in. So that song makes perfect sense to me. That's the way I, you know, that's how the way I leave the house each day.
This is a song about no salvation.
At all.
Salvation is an impossibility for this person and they are doomed.
And you can still sing.
Yeah. And it sounds like you overdubbed your voices to have a kind of chorus effect, as if like there's a whole family of singers or a whole room of singers.
Yeah, it's just Rennie. It's just Rennie and me.
And I think there is a comfort in that. At least we're all together in hell singing.
Okay. So this is The Lost Soul, The Handsome Family, my guest Brett and Rennie Sparks.
What an awful day.
What an awful day.
When the judgment comes.
When the judgment comes.
And the sinners hear.
And the sinners hear.
Their eternal doom.
Their eternal doom.
At the sad decree.
At the sad decree.
They'll depart for a.
They'll depart for a.
Into endless woe.
Into endless woe.
And gloom.
Woe and gloom.
I'm paying now.
I'm paying now.
The penalty.
The penalty.
That the unredeemed.
Must ever pay.
Must ever pay. Though for help I cry.
Though for help I cry.
It is all in vain.
It is all in vain.
For alas I'm doomed.
For alas I'm doomed.
If I could recall.
That was The Handsome Family, which is my guest, Brett and Rennie Sparks. The song is The Lost Soul. It's a traditional song that they learned from a Doc Watson album. That's just so chilling. I really love your recording of that. Brett and Rennie Sparks, thank you so much.
Such a pleasure to talk to you. Such a great honor. Thank you.
Brett and Rennie Sparks perform under the name The Handsome Family. Their new album is called Unseen. On Sunday night, HBO premieres Westworld, a new futuristic series starring Anthony Hopkins, Evan Rachel Wood, and James Marsden. Adapted from the 1973 movie Westworld, it's about a high-tech theme park whose visitors get to live out their wildest dreams of being in the Old West. Our critic at large, John Powers, has seen the first few episodes and says that the show has a lot more on its mind than you may expect.
I have a friend in London who's at war with her car's GPS. Although she nearly always puts it on, she's driven mad by its voice, which is female, and refuses to follow its directions. She spends whole trips arguing with, barking at, and sometimes cursing this imaginary woman. She'd never be this rude to an actual human being. But of course, a GPS doesn't have feelings. But what if it did? That's one of the many timely questions raised by Westworld, the darkly exciting new series that's HBO's biggest gamble since Game of Thrones. Developed by Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy, it's an ambitious reboot and rethink of the clever but clunky 1973 movie by Michael Crichton, who would go on to write the more popular but less provocative Jurassic Park. The show takes its title from the name of a futuristic theme park, where visitors come to live out their Wild West fantasies. Inhabited by astonishingly lifelike androids known as hosts, Westworld lets guests ride the high country, gun down an outlaw, fall for a cowboy, or bed a beautiful bar girl, all with no risk. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, the park is run by a huge team, topped by its genius creator, Dr. Robert Ford, played by Anthony Hopkins, its lead programmer, Bernard Lowe, that's Jeffrey Wright, and tough Teresa Cullen, who represents corporate, which has sinister plans of its own. She's played by Cincy Babbitt-Knudsen from Borgen. Everything goes smoothly until there's a glitch in the android's operating system. Triggered by an apt line from Romeo and Juliet, "These violent delights have violent ends," some of the hosts begin acting out in nasty ways. Not to give anything away, but this makes matters tricky for everyone, from Westworld's management to a scary, ultra-violent repeat guest known as Gunslinger. That's Ed Harris of the Chilling Blue Eyes. At the center of the action are William, a nice guy tourist played by Jimmy Simpson, and the show's heroine, Dolores Abernathy. Brilliantly played by Evan Rachel Wood, she's a rancher's daughter who discovers that life is a lot more complicated than she ever realized. Here, Jeffrey Wright's character, Bernard, meets with Hopkins's pensive, almost Olympian Dr. Ford to discuss why the androids have taken to misbehaving.
So our creatures have been misbehaving. You haven't yet isolated the bug. That's so unlike you, Bernard. Unless, of course, you have and are simply embarrassed by the result.
It's the code you added, sir. The reveries. It has some...
Mistakes. Is the word you're too embarrassed to use. You ought not to be a product of a trillion of them. The evolution forged the entirety of sentient life on this planet using only one tool. The mistake.
Now, Westworld is clearly a big-budget production, filled with big-name performers. I haven't even mentioned Tandy Newton's sexy madam, or James Marsden's preeningly romantic gunslinger. And its nifty production design lovingly recreates the Old West, Hollywood style, and gives us the cool, soullessly sterile labs where scientists continually program and rebuild murdered androids. As you might guess, the series asks us to think about our relationship to technology, in particular to machines that come ever closer to displaying human intelligence and emotions, as the android hosts do here. After all, it's one thing for a techno genie to satisfy our needs, quite another for it to have needs of its own. What if we create beings that can grow beyond our ability to know and control them? In Crichton's original film, the human heroes are threatened by run-amok androids. This new version flips that idea, conjuring a reality in which the androids are abused by human beings. It joins a long tradition that sympathizes with man-made creatures, like Boris Karloff's Frankenstein, who was as touching as he was scary. And it joins movies like Blade Runner and the recent Ex Machina in suggesting that fabricated creatures may be smarter, more passionate, and indeed more profoundly alive than the people who made and enslaved them. At bottom, this unexpectedly resonant show isn't really about technology, but about the human soul, whose operating system has a glitch that some call original sin. Watching Westworld's guests exploit the hosts for their many different pleasures, I found myself thinking about tourism in our own world, where travelers often treat foreign lands as theme parks and locals as disposable extras. Think of Ryan Lochte in Rio. Or even worse, visit exotic countries to buy easy, cheap sex or slaughter their animals for sport. Bursting with violent delights and violent ends, Westworld is shot through with a melancholy truth, that nothing is more human than behaving inhumanly.
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. He reviewed the new HBO series Westworld. When we think of the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico 6 years ago, we remember the video of crude oil gushing from the ocean floor for months. But it's easy to forget that 11 people died in the explosions and fire on the oil rig that led to the environmental disaster. Our next guest is Peter Berg, who directed the new film Deepwater Horizon. It stars Mark Wahlberg and Kurt Russell and depicts the final chaotic hours of the crew on the oil rig and explores the causes of the blowout that triggered the catastrophe. Peter Berg has been acting, writing, and directing films and TV for 30 years. He starred in the TV medical series Chicago Hope, directed the film Friday Night Lights, and developed it as an NBC TV series as its executive producer. His other films include Battleship, Lone Survivor, and the forthcoming Patriots Day. Peter Berg spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies last Monday.
Well, Peter Berg, welcome back to Fresh Air. What got you interested in this story?
The first thing that really kind of stuck out to me in terms of making a film was a 60 Minutes piece that I saw that really focused on this one man's story, Mike Williams, who was the last man to get off the rig. And, you know, I'd known the story of the blowout and of the environmental disaster, the oil spill, the attempt to stop the spill, all that. But I had never really thought about, well, what led up to that spill? Who were these people that worked on the rig? What did they do? And why did it all sort of go wrong? And it was just a very interesting story.
It is, yeah. Now, 11 people died in the explosion and fire. I understand you met with the families of all 11?
I did, and that was another aspect of my research leading up to committing to do the film that really kind of sealed the deal for me. And I met with the families of these 11 men who died, and you know, when you meet with these families, you're obviously hit hard with the grief they're experiencing from that loss. But there's this added grief, which is that most people, when they hear about the Deepwater Horizon, and if they do hear that someone died, their first reaction is often, well, you know, those guys caused the oil spill, so, you know, maybe that's fate, right? That's karma. And when I realized that, you know, not only did these 11 men not cause the oil spill, that oil spill was caused by decisions being made by guys that work for companies like BP that are way, way above their pay grade, but that these men actually died trying to prevent the oil spill. They stayed at their workstations, you know, when they could have jumped off the rig onto the lifeboats. They stayed on the rig and attempted very hard and courageously to try and prevent that blowout. When I realized the families, you know, had A, lost their loved one, and then B, had this public misperception of what happened, that kind of got me going, and I was a bit angered and inspired by that.
Now, the Deepwater Horizon is actually kind of a floating machine that drills deep water wells. It doesn't extract the oil. It positions itself, and in this case, drops a drill bit a mile to the seafloor, and then another 2 miles in this case to reach an oil deposit. It's amazing. You want to just describe a bit what the rig is like, its dimensions?
Sure. Well, these rigs are absolutely huge. You know, they sit about 150 feet tall. They're almost an acre in their size, you know, the amount of space they consume over the water. The drill, the actual derrick, the top of the derrick goes up about 450 feet. And like you say, they're capable of reaching extreme depths just to get to the bottom of the ocean. And then once they get there, they're capable of boring extremely deep into the earth. In the case of the deep water rig, this was the deepest that man has ever drilled into the earth, which kind of provided us with like an Icarus in reverse type of a metaphor. You know, how it wasn't how high man can fly before he crashes. It was in this case, how deep can we go before the pressures of these oil reserves become too great and they blow out? But, you know, I was very interested to find out that these rigs are giant ships. They're controlled by about 15 different massive propellers that are communicating with satellites that can constantly turn and readjust their speeds based on current and wind direction to keep the rig centered directly over that pipe. The other thing is, you know, most people just don't realize that they're not pumping oil. They've got to find the oil, which is a very complex event in amongst itself. Once they find it, if they're right, they go down and they bore down, and it can take, you know, a month or 2 months just to make contact with that oil reserve. And then once you've made contact, that's like basically sticking your finger into a nuclear bomb. It wants to blow. So they've got to then manage extraordinarily high pressure. And that's where pieces of equipment like the blowout preventer that is represented in our film come into play. And these very smart guys, a bunch of like MIT-style engineers, are sitting on top of a nuclear bomb trying to stabilize it. And that's the game these guys play, and it's pretty impressive to watch.
Right, and if they do it right, they drill, they find the oil, then they cap it, stabilize it, and move on, and then an extraction rig comes.
Then the
out.
Lamer crews, as they say in our movie, as Mark's daughter says, the Lamer crews come, and they just simply turn on a faucet, you know, underwater. It's actually not quite that simple, but the real challenging work is in the finding of the oil and then the making contact with that oil. But then the real challenge is stabilizing it. That oil is like a wild monster that wants to blow out. And that's, of course, what, you know, went wrong on that rig that day about 6 years ago.
Now, when you take us onto the rig in this film, I mean, I'm reminded that most of us civilians who don't live in the industrial world, I think would be very unsettled, maybe really frightened just to be on this thing, because the weight and the scale of the machines and the chains and the drills and the stairs, it would be really unsettling and kind of scary. And I'm wondering, the people who worked on them regularly, do you think they lived with a sense of daily danger? I mean, obviously something like this had never happened, but was it a routine for them, or did it also kind of have a menacing, scary quality to it?
I mean, I think they definitely were aware of the dangers. I mean, you're absolutely right. Around every corner is a very serious injury just waiting to happen. And safety is something that is talked about and stressed consistently on these rigs, that it would be impossible to not be constantly vigilant. But the ultimate fear is falling off the rig. I mean, that's the one thing you never, ever, ever want to do, is get in the water and jump off that rig. You're 50 miles off the coast, there's heavy currents, the water's on fire, it's the dead of night, steel and oil and all kinds of things are falling everywhere. There's sharks, and the fact that some of these men and one female had no option other than to jump. When I really understood that, it reminded me of, you know, what we in New York experienced, and other people obviously around the world, 9/11, when, you know, people had absolutely no choice but to jump out of the towers. That was, to me, it was almost as desperate an act, and that was, you know, obviously something that I found very emotional and hit me very hard when I was thinking about doing the film.
You had to recreate the rig in some way, and I was a little surprised to read that you didn't actually have access to a deep water rig to film on, because it looks like you're there. How did you pull this off? Did you reconstruct a rig on dry land?
Well, yeah, we had problems because BP was not particularly thrilled that we were making the film. You know, BP and the oil industry in general appropriately wields a lot of power in that community, and they pay a lot of mortgages. And because we were making a film about the oil spill or the oil blowout and what happened that day, BP was not only were they not a big advocate or very supportive, but they actually became a very effective disruptor, and we couldn't get access to many of the things that we wanted to. We couldn't get access to the boats, to some of the helicopters, to some of the men and women that we wanted to speak to. But the biggest thing we couldn't get access to, which is what we wanted the most, was an oil rig, you know, one of these big deep water platforms. I'd always thought we would be able to film a portion of the movie on a real, you know, rig. And when it became apparent that we couldn't, the next best option was to build a sizable, you know, 85% to scale recreation of a rig, which we did, and it was an extraordinary set. And we built that in a parking lot of an abandoned Six Flags amusement park just outside of New Orleans, and it was an extraordinary set.
Was there water? I mean, you know,
there was. The set we built was about 85 feet in the air, was about the size of about 1.5 football fields, and underneath it was a 5-acre water tank that we could set on fire, and we could, you know, blow up giant pieces of that set and blow oil and mud up in the air about 150 feet and land helicopters on it and do all kinds of things to try and provide the audience with an experience that was felt as authentic and, you know, non-computer effect created as possible.
I imagine the locals were kind of interested to see this thing appear in their neighborhood.
Yeah, I mean, we were way out in the swamps, and, you know, now that the Six Flags had built itself kind of out in a pretty remote area, so we didn't get a lot of visits from locals, but it was full of alligators. I think we pulled about 15 alligators out of our water tank, dozens of water moccasins, and there were wild pigs everywhere. So like you'd go to the bathroom and, you know, you come out of the bathroom to be four wild pigs standing in a parking lot staring at you. And you just like would go back in the bathroom real quick and start screaming for help. And we had a lot of visits from those types of critters, but not a lot of humans ventured out where we were. It was also hot. We were deep in the heart of summer. So we had it to ourselves.
Deep water drilling is complicated, and you had to decide how much of that complexity to include in the film, because what went wrong involves decisions and actions that are technical. How did you address that?
I had the extreme fortune of spending time almost in what we called oil school, which, you know, we was set up for us by some of our producers, and we were able to spend a lot of time with petroleum engineers and deep water drilling experts. And they took us slowly and carefully deep enough into the process so we were able to kind of all agree that it was fascinating. You know, and it's my belief that, you know, nobody likes to consider themselves stupid, and people actually like to learn things. And I felt that if we could find a way of presenting enough of the science to the audience so that they could keep up, that we could lose them at times or be not speak down to them and not have to dumb down the science too much, so that they would understand, get the gist of what was happening and understand the basic elements of what was happening on that rig without necessarily understanding every word that was said. And we, you know, worked hard to find the right mix, the balance of science and then just, you know, common speak so that the audience could stay with it. And I'm very happy with the way that's playing now.
Okay, well, here's the challenge. You want to give us a short version of what went wrong on the Deepwater Horizon?
Right. Well, there's no one that can – that's a great question. And nobody can answer that question conclusively for sure. And there's still so many differences of opinion. However, the one area that almost everyone seems to agree on, everyone I talk to, and I've asked that question maybe to 150 people who are all very connected with the rig. You know, what went wrong? Why did it happen? And almost everyone seems to believe, and now at the bottom of these wells, deep underground, they pump cement. They call it cement, but it's cement, concrete. They pump it deep down into the earth, and that cement forms sort of a protective casing that's designed to keep the oil from all flooding up out of that hole. It's a very thick, heavy wall of concrete that poured deep underneath the ocean and the Earth's surface. And if that cement is poured properly, it hardens, obviously, and that's the beginning of the management of that intense pressure. If that cement is not poured properly, and if that cement starts to break apart or you know, is compromised, you can get too much oil streaming to the hole that takes the oil up out of the earth. It's very widely believed that there was something wrong with that cement job. And one of the reasons why people point a finger at BP is that before you declare a well safe, you have to do something like a final test where you send sonar images deep down into the earth to test the solidity of that concrete. And that test costs a couple of $100,000. BP didn't do that test. They sent the team home that's supposed to do the test, saving themselves a couple of $100,000. And, you know, it's many people's belief that they didn't do the test because they just didn't want to get any bad news. They knew if the test came up bad, they're going to have to rip it all out and do it again. They were in a hurry to get out of there. Not doing that test, not checking the cement, saved them $200,000 in the short term and cost them $60 billion and 11 men who lost their lives in the long term. So that to me is, you know, most people seem to agree that that's at the heart of what went wrong.
One more thing. You've had some great acting roles. How do you like acting as opposed to directing, and do you plan to do more of it?
You know, I found at a certain point in my acting career that I was just bored. I had too much energy. I had too many ideas. It was a movie, Copland, that I did some time ago, and I was on the set. I was acting. I had a small role in it. Robert De Niro was there, and Harvey Keitel, and Ray Liotta, and Sylvester Stallone had gotten real big for this movie and was doing this whole dramatic, turn, and Harvey Weinstein was the producer, and it was a, you know, very prestigious film, and I had a small part, so I was kind of sitting around on the set all the time, and there was this young director who was in the middle of it all, who had written a script and was directing it, and he was in the middle of all these, you know, arguments with Robert De Niro and creative conversations with Stallone, and Harvey Weinstein had his arm around him, and I was like, man, that looks like the fun job. And I walked up to him, and his name was James Mangold, and I said, hey, could I ask you a question? And he had this look of, he was just in the middle of this, like, wild ride or something, you know, in the middle of directing. His eyes were wide, and he just looked very alive, and he kind of looked at me. So what is it? I said, how do you get this job, man? How do you do this? And he said, what are you talking about? I said, I want your job. He said, really? I said, I do. He said, well, you got to write a movie. And I'm like, great, well, how do you write a movie? And he kind of took me through his process, which was, you know, Sharpie pens and note cards. And he said, do you have any ideas? I said, well, yeah, I kind of have some ideas. He said, well, write them out in note cards. And don't stop the note cards until you finish it, because you'll quit otherwise. And I did that, and I made my first film, which was called Very Bad Things. And it was about some guys at a bachelor party, and things didn't go well for them.
Vegas, right?
Yeah. And, yeah. Yep, in Vegas. And probably 80% of the critics that saw it hated that movie horribly and ripped it. But there were just enough who liked it to keep me going. And I kind of found that's what I prefer. I mean, I like acting for fun, but I'm very happy to be doing what I'm doing now.
Peter Berg, thanks so much. It's been fun.
A pleasure talking to you. And thank you for watching the movie. Really appreciate it.
Peter Berg directed the new film Deepwater Horizon. He spoke with Dave Davies last Monday. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberto Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Thea Chaloner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer for online media. I'm Terry Gross.